Warning dated Tuesday adds that there are no specific details beyond aspirational planning, and there are no changes to the nation's threat level. Federal agencies regularly issue advisory warnings, but this one has unusually blunt language. A spokesman for the Department of Homeland Security said that they would continue to investigate all leads. He said there might be increased police and security presence in New York City and other large metropolitan areas. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
Former First Lady Barbara Bush is resting comfortably at a Houston hospital after undergoing laparoscopic surgery to repair an ulcer. A spokesman for Mrs. Bush says the former First Lady is likely to remain in Houston's Methodist Hospital until next week. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our number two of our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. The second hour of the program today, as the first, comes to you from the Focus 580 archives. This is a show that we first broadcast on September 9th. So do keep in mind as you listen that this program is an archive, will not be taking calls. And I think perhaps we might have made some references in this show to the fact that the guest, Raj Mohan Gandhi, was going to be doing a book signing. Well, you missed that, but you still, of course, can read his book. So again, it's Focus 580 from September 9th. In this hour of the show, we will not be taking calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the life of India's great independence leader, Mahatma Gandhi. He's someone who certainly has been an inspiration to political activists around the world. He is known in India as the father of the nation for his leadership of the country's independence movement. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with someone who also knew him as grandfather. Our guest for the show is Raj Mohan Gandhi. He is research professor at the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and is the author of a recently published biography of his grandfather. The title of the book is Gandhi, the Man, His People, and the Empire. It is published by the University of California Press. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. Good to be here.
Your grandfather certainly is one of the most famous people of the 20th century, without a doubt. He is one of those individuals where we could go out on the street with his photograph and show it to people, and they would know who it was. But it seems that one of the things that you're interested in is trying to give people an idea of who he was, perhaps at a deeper or more human level, to see him not as an icon, but as you knew him, as an actual living, breathing person.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Everybody does know his face. Many people may even be able to sketch his outline, but not many people know him as a human being. Mm-hmm. Perhaps some are familiar with Einstein's remarkable lines that he wrote in 1939. I might just take, read. What Einstein said in 1939 about Gandhi, a leader of his people, unsupported by any outside authority, etc., etc. A man who's confronted the brutality of Europe with the dignity of the simple human being and at all times risen superior. This is 1939. Mm-hmm. Then this is the famous line from Einstein that many are familiar with. Generations to come, it may be, will scarce believe that such a one as this ever in flesh and blood walked upon this earth. So that's quite an astounding statement. People, of course, are aware that he did live and was very active, but they don't know too much about him. Mm-hmm. They know that Gandhi was a politician, successful politician. They know that he had spiritual interests and pursuits. But the human being, as a boy, as a child, and as a student in London, as an activist in South Africa, then as a leader of the freedom movement in India, as a husband, as a father, as a grandfather, he had relationships with all kinds of people, difficult relationships. So all those I've tried to, you might say, discover and convey in, I hope, a readable manner. Mm.
And now, he was, when he died, when he was assassinated, you were 12.
Yes.
So you had the opportunity to know him that well,
yes,
but certainly know him as a boy and knew him as your grandfather. So
yeah,
it seems that in part you're doing this not just for the rest of us, but you're also doing this for yourself.
I am, very much so, yes. I had many questions about him myself. Of course, I knew him as a boy, but then how much does a boy know? I had some wonderful interactions with him, especially between the ages of 10 and 12, which is when he was going from 76 to 78. This is the final phase of his life, much of which was spent in New Delhi, where I was going to school. So I was, I had this wonderful relationship with him, but that doesn't enable me to understand the man. Mm. So I had to do an enormous amount of study and research. And this is a very, very large book. And I have to say that there have been so many scores of books. Louis Fisher in this country wrote a book shortly after Gandhi died, in the late 40s or early 50s. And then in the late 60s, Erik Erikson, the great psychoanalyst, wrote a wonderful, brilliant book about Gandhi. There have been some other books since then, but it is perhaps fair to say that this does give the complete story of the man and of his life as a human being, perhaps for the first time in many years. And there's lots and lots of new material the family had, other material that is in the public domain, but was not available to earlier biographers.
Well, I want to talk particularly about those parts of his life that perhaps may be a little bit less well-known. People perhaps might know more about his activities in the independence, in the Indian independence movement. Let's start with his boyhood and particularly the influence of his mother in starting him off on the road where he would eventually go. Tell us about what was Gandhi like as a child?
Well, he was really two things. One part of him was very timid, even cowardly. He was afraid of ghosts. He was afraid of the dark. He was afraid of serpents and robbers. Another part of him was very radical. He wanted, for instance, to deal with this untouchability notion, which was, you know, he was born in an Orthodox Hindu home. And his mother had said to him that if this boy, who was roughly his age, who came to clean the toilet in this home, when he comes, don't play with him, don't touch him. If you touch him, you should go and have a bath to cleanse yourself after this pollution. So he asks, why? Why shouldn't I play with this boy? And then there was also the Hindu-Muslim question. He was also cautioned about not touching Muslim boys. So as a boy, he wants to fight this prejudice, whether it's about the so-called untouchables or on the Hindu-Muslim question. And then he also is experimenting with meat eating. Now, he was born in a vegetarian home, mm-hmm. and eating meat was terrible. But he secretly eats meat because he's been told by some of his school friends that if Indian boys eat meat, they'll become tough and strong and they'll be able to fight and defeat the British. So on the one hand, there is a very timid boy who's afraid. On the other hand, there is a boy who wants to do big things. He wants India's independence. He wants to address the untouchability question. He wants to know why Hindus and Muslims shouldn't get along. And then he makes this determined effort to go to England. Now he's an older boy. He's now 17, 18, 19. His father is dead by this time. And he's determined to go to England. And his mother is not for it. And his relatives say this is sinful. It is sinful for Orthodox Hindus to cross the sea. You're forbidden, but he somehow fights his way. So this timid boy is also a fighter. And when he leaves this town of Rajkot in Western India, some months thereafter, he records his departure from Rajkot in a diary entry. And he when he's at the railway station in Rajkot, lots of people go to see him off. And he, in his recollection of this event a few months later, he lists the names of all these people who had come to see him off. And there's scores of young men, and they're Hindus and Muslims. So this 18-year-old boy, who part of him is very timid, is also a leader in his own right. So the kind of the future Gandhi, to some extent, can be seen even in his boyhood and adolescence.
So here he is wrestling with enormous questions, and these are questions that people in India are still wrestling with.
Exactly.
And one wonders how it is that someone at that age is even prompted to think about these things rather than simply accepting, well, that's the way that it is. And if your parents and the elders in your community say that's the way it is, what is it do you think that would prompt someone of his age to challenge that and say, well, why is it that's the way that it is? Or maybe ask, should this really be the way that it is?
Yeah, this is a question I cannot say I have answered. I have noted this remarkable fact. Why he does this at a young age when he's 10, 11, 12, 13, not that he's very seriously says, yes, this is going to be my life's aim, no. But we get indications that he's wrestling with these issues. But why he did that at the age of 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, while remaining a kind of normal boy in other ways, I can't say I fully understood or so, but there is a sense in him, even at a young age, that he should do some unusual and difficult things.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Rajmohan Gandhi. He is a research professor here at the University of Illinois at the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. He is the author of a recently published biography of Mahatma Gandhi. The title of the book is Gandhi, the Man, His People, and the Empire. It is published by the University of California Press and is recently out. This is a book that is the story in part of his own family, about his grandfather, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think probably one of the things about this first period of his life up until the point where he goes to England that I'm sure catches people's attention is the fact that when he was married, when he was very young. Not even 13 years old. And started relatively young into family life, and that when he went at the age of 18 to London to study law, had already been married at this point for several years,
and had a boy,
and was already a father at this point. His eldest son was born. And I suppose that people ask questions about that simply because that's. We don't do that kind of thing. And one wonders, well, what sort of effect would that have on somebody have that dimension to their life or that feeling of responsibility that young?
Well, of course, one thing to recognize is that this was the done thing at the time in India. Everybody got married, you might say, by parents at that age. Kastur, the girl he married, who was a few months older than him, lived in a house literally 50 yards from his house. They belonged not only to the same caste, they belonged to the same sub-caste. So it was legitimate for these two families to come together. She was a very attractive young girl. She was far more courageous than him. I've referred to his fear of the dark, his fear of ghosts. She was completely free of these fears. And he was quite embarrassed to find that she was much tougher than he was. People got married very young. Then they didn't necessarily live together right away. The girl would often be with her family for a long period. This is also what happened in this case. But yes, they were together, if not continuously, for a good deal of the time from, say, the ages of 15 to onwards. And by the time he left at the age of 18 and a half, he already was the father of a boy of several months in age. And he tried very hard shortly after his marriage to her to educate her. He failed totally. She was very independent, very courageous, but she resisted him successfully as far as getting taught. I don't know whether he was intelligent enough in his strategy. He persuaded, he pressed, he urged, but she completely resisted. So there was no way in which he even wrote letters to her when he was 3 years in England. Mm. There is this young wife and the boy. So he corresponds with her through other relatives, other members of the family. So this is also, again, what did happen in those days. When a husband and wife, their kind of personal relations were often indirect relations, especially when they were far apart. Yeah.
And also we should note that they remained married for 61 years until she died in 1944.
Yes.
And so she was with him and was very important support and strength for him for all of that period.
All of his life. Oh, I mean, she plays perhaps the greatest role in this man's life in the decades to come. And then they would in all have four sons. They did not have any daughters. And the four sons would between them have 15 grandchildren for Kastur and Mohandas Gandhi. Of these 15, eight are still living. And when she died in 44, as you rightly point out, she and her husband were both in detention. They were they were prisoners of the British at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was able, along with my siblings, to see her a few days before she died. They were not allowed much correspondence or certainly to meet relatives while they were being detained. But because she was about to die, the sons and grandchildren were allowed to call. So yes, she, although she resisted his attempts to educate her, played a great part. She went to prison herself many times in the freedom movement. She was a great figure for many people in India as a wife who went all the way with her husband. But she was also effective because in standing up to him at times. Gandhi has several times said that because of my wife's firmness in dissenting from me, in standing up to me, I learned the power of no. And that indeed, Gandhi says that some of his, you might say, belief in the power of nonviolent resistance came from the way she resisted him.
Hmm. When he went to London to study law, you said this was something that was, I mean, not everybody in his family or in his community were in favor of this, but something that he really wanted
yes,
to do.
Yes.
And so he arrives in London. He's 18 years old, coming out of a very different kind of culture milieu, someone who had very strong beliefs and commitments, was very strongly committed to being vegetarian, which was maybe not always easy for people to understand. He didn't drink alcohol, was married, had a child, was committed to his wife. It must have been a little difficult for him to fit himself into this new environment, or perhaps for people there to kind of understand who he was and what he believed in, and the fact that he did believe in these things very, very strongly.
Yes, well, the vegetarian part is a little interesting and not so, you might say, straightforward. His family had committed themselves and him. He was obliged, he was asked to, he was required to take a vow before he was allowed to go to England by the family. Mm-hmm. A, that he would not touch meat. B, he would not have any relations with other women. And C, no alcohol. No meat, no alcohol, no women. Now, as far as meat was concerned, he had been secretly eating meat. And in fact, his plan was, once he was free from parental domination, he would eat meat. So he was committed to a vow against eating meat, but he himself wanted to. So as a matter of fact, it was in London where he met some unusual British vegetarians. And that is how he became a vegetarian, not just by compulsion, but by choice. Mm-hmm. That was an interesting feature of his life in England. He had interesting curiosity also by this time about religions. And he reads the Bible for the first time when he's in London. He reads the Gita, one of the sacred texts of the Hindu religion, for the first time in the English language when he's a student in London. So he meets with kind of these thoughts from the whole wide world while he's in London. He also meets men and women, and he's invited to occasions where he has a chance to meet British young women. And for some time, he doesn't tell them that he has a wife back home. But after a while, there's one particular young woman that he's been seeing for a while, not in a kind of serious way, but he's been seeing her. And then he has this compulsion to let her know, and the other older lady who introduced this young woman and him together to each other, he has to let them know that he is in fact married and he's the father of a son. So he writes a letter. This is a very interesting letter he writes while he's in England. It reveals this self-examining person who has as Erickson, you know, has said about Mohandas, that he had a precocious conscience. Of course, there were examples of this even when he was a boy. But now he writes this letter to this mother, to this older woman, and asks this older woman to inform the young woman that this is what has been happening. Mm-hmm. And he expresses an apology for that.
I think he felt bad because he felt that he was misleading them or that he was not being completely honest. And I don't know, on their end, did they really feel that that was such a big thing? But he apparently thought that it was a big
thing. And they wrote to him saying that the older woman, that the younger woman and I, we had a hearty laugh over it. And we had a joke at your expense, but we are very keen to see you again. That is an aspect of his. But it was a very important time, these 3 years in London. And he also learned politics in a new way. He followed the Irish struggle against British rule very, very closely. There was no suggestion while he was in London. Now, remember, we are now talking about 1888 to 1891. People from India were not so many in the UK. They were few and far between. They were exotic. He didn't experience any racial discrimination at all. He made many friends. But there are signs that he was interested in politics, the Irish battle for independence. And they're also very interesting and revealing signs. He cultivates, for instance, Muslim students also from India and indeed elsewhere, because he knows that unless the Hindus and the Muslims work together in India, that India cannot get independence. So he is cultivating them. He meets Parsi, Zoroastrian boys also from India. So he's already trying to reach out beyond, outside his Hindu fold.
Yeah. I think it is interesting that I think prior to coming to London, while he had commitment to certain ways of living, perhaps he would not have considered himself particularly religious.
That is correct.
And that this was a time when he was exploring some of the basic tenets of Hinduism as well as other faiths as well. So he was starting to broaden his reading, not only in the faith in which he was rooted, but in others as well, and starting to open up to various kinds of spiritual ideas.
That's exactly true. In fact, the boy who left India at the age of 18 for England was very keen on quote-unquote reforms. And these reforms largely meant accepting lots of Western ideas and rejecting many Indian or Oriental or Eastern ideas. He wanted independence. He wasn't happy that the British were ruling India. But like many other Indians of the time, his reading of British rule was very ambivalent. They'd done some good things, and we must learn from them. So he went to London both to understand, I'm saying this not that he had formulated this in his mind, but unconsciously, both to understand possible future foes, but also to meet people from whom much could be learned for India.
We are at our midpoint here. Just let me very quickly introduce again our guest, Rajmohan Gandhi. He is research professor at the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Illinois. He's the author of Gandhi, The Man, His People, and the Empire. It's a biography of the man who was India's great independence leader and was also his grandfather. The book is published by University of California Press. We do have someone here who is calling in with a question, so perhaps if you would put on the headphones, we will talk with them. And this is someone in Champaign County, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. I've always heard about M.N. Roy, but never many details, and I confess I haven't done but more than a little Googling right now and some reading in the past. He was also a revolutionary. He was a communist but denounced communism in 1930, fairly early, and died in 54, and was sort of, in some way, the other pole of the activism for independent India. That was the name of his journal, and there was one point where I just noticed that he had asked your grandfather to write something for the journal, and your father answered back, "Render mute service." Now, I don't know how reliable this is, but I wonder if you could elucidate the relationship between the two. And it seems to me that not to do any disservice to your grandfather as, you know, leading the salt boycott and the cotton textile boycott of British goods and all of the activism that he did, but there were a lot of people that worked on it, and I think M.N. Roy is probably one of the people that is not as acceptable as a person for the I don't know if you know gather what I'm getting at, but
sure,
could
I
you
do
say a bit about him.
Of course,
and your relations with the grandfather.
Yeah, thank you for that important point. And there's absolutely no doubt that M.N. Roy and a great many others were valiant colleagues and comrades with Gandhi. Many of them were active associates. Others pursued their own independent line, and all of them played roles in India's independence. M.N. Roy, as you said, became a communist. He was also a Trotskyite for some time. Then he broke with the communists in the late 30s or early 40s, and also led his own, you might say, branch of the Indian independence movement. Afterwards, his movement became known as a radical humanist movement. And he, and especially after Gandhi's death, M.N. Roy also advanced ideas that are very similar to Gandhi's ideas, and on the need for the Hindus and Muslims to work together and for the caste system, the oppressive caste system to be fought. Roy also supported Gandhi. But when Roy was a communist, Gandhi didn't share Roy's communistic ideas. But Roy certainly has played a very great part. This particular incident that you mentioned about Roy soliciting an article from Gandhi and Gandhi sending that particular reply, I'm not familiar with that particular incident.
I see. Yeah, it was according to Wikipedia, and maybe it's reliable, it was 1930, so he broke quite early and had this journal. It's an interesting story, and I'm curious about that particular incident and when it happened in the whole scheme of things, if indeed it is reliable.
No, that particular sentence of mute service, that is very typical of Gandhi's style of speaking. So there is a suggestion that it may well be true. And I don't remember exactly the year when Roy broke from with communism. It may have been much earlier than the late 30s, as I'd mentioned.
Right. Well, he was certainly not mute, and I was glad. And it was a great voice for independence and anti-colonialism, and it rings to the day. And we all know that it influenced Martin Luther King quite dramatically.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. People certainly will associate Gandhi with India and with Indian independence, and rightly so. But I think that it is true to say that if you look at the periods of his life that perhaps were most important in forming the person that he would become, the activist for human rights and civil rights, and the tactics that he would use, you have to look at South Africa.
Absolutely.
For this time, where he studied law in London, came back and lived in India, I think, for a couple of, maybe about 2 years.
Yes, exactly.
And then went to South Africa. And I think that he was only supposed to go for a year.
Yes.
And this turned out to be very, very important. And you said before that he really, racism was not something that he experienced when he was in London. Well, certainly it was something he experienced in South Africa. Tell us about his time in South Africa.
As you say, he went there for a year. He ended up spending 20 years there. And yes, he ran into racism in a big way. Almost as soon as he arrived on his travels, he was pushed out, thrown out, beaten up, not allowed to stay in the hotel. He was kicked. He was physically roughed up, insulted, humiliated for year after year after year. And that is where he did find, as he himself says, his purpose in life. And to begin with, he tried to fight for the rights of the Indian community in South Africa on the basis of British pledges and commitments. South Africa, too, was kind of under the British umbrella. And the British had committed themselves to some kind of racial equality. And Gandhi said, this is what is happening, and do something about it. And when they did not, so that also played a very large part in his disillusionment with, you might say, the British scheme of things in the world. And in South Africa, he had a wonderful advantage because there were people there from different parts of India, not in immense numbers, but in, you might say, quote-unquote, manageable numbers in different parts of South Africa. And that way Gandhi came to know all of India, but in a miniature form, as they were represented, as Indians were represented in South Africa. There were Hindus of different kinds, Muslims of different kinds, Sikhs and Christians and Parsis. In South Africa, he also had a wonderful relationship with white Jews, British, German, and others. There were two in particular, Henry Pollack, who was a journalist with a British background, and Hermann Kallenbach, who was an architect with a German background. These were two absolutely close, intimate Jewish colleagues of Gandhi in South Africa. So there he, of course, fights effectively for Indian rights. He has some friends among the Africans, though not so many. His interactions with the Africans, the black Africans in South Africa, are relatively few. And the Africans are cautious because they don't want to invite repression from the British, from the white government. And the Indians are also cautious because they don't want to invite further repression from the British by working with the black Africans. So Gandhi's interaction, this is worth noting, because subsequently, of course, the African Americans were greatly inspired by Gandhi's struggle. But we should recognize that while Gandhi was in South Africa, his interactions with the black Africans were very limited. The black Africans were inspired by the Indian example, mm-hmm. but there was no partnership or joint struggle at that time. When Gandhi was again and again humiliated and physically and in other ways kind of roughed up in South Africa, one response of his was, wait a minute, I feel so bad, other Indians in South Africa are feeling so bad about this, but this is exactly what we are doing to the so-called untouchables in India. So his receiving this kind of treatment in South Africa played a large part in the subsequent battle that Gandhi put up for the rights of the low castes and the untouchables in India.
Yeah. The thing, probably above anything else, what he is known for, the thing that inspires so many people, including Martin Luther King, was his commitment to nonviolent political action.
Yeah.
Very, very important, and certainly has become very important to other people working on behalf of human rights and civil rights around the world. As a tactic, where exactly does this come from?
Yes. Incidentally, the first rally of Indian activists in South Africa committed to nonviolent defiance took place on September 11, 1906 in Johannesburg, in South Africa. And so that is the start of what Gandhi would call satyagraha, firmness in the truth, nonviolent struggle against injustice. Where did it come from? Well, it came from his experiences. It came from his reading. People don't always recognize that Gandhi was a very careful and serious reader of texts. And while he was in South Africa, in his first few months, he spent a great deal of time reading the history of the 1857 rebellion in India, which was a very bloody affair. with great violence, first from the Indian side and then tremendous repression. For every white person killed, 100 Indians were killed. And Gandhi studied several volumes of what happened in the 1857 movement. So he saw that these violent movements invite more violence, don't achieve their aim, and don't very seldom seem to work. And sadly, in 1857, they did not work. He also read a good deal of Tolstoy when he was 23, 24. And Tolstoy's advocacy of nonviolence also greatly influenced. He was aware of Thoreau, and he had read something of Thoreau also. And his reading of Thoreau also played a part. And he often referred to Thoreau as an absolutely extraordinary person, human being, who opposed wars that America was fighting in the 1840s. Mm. So he reads Thoreau, he reads Tolstoy, he reads much more of Tolstoy than he does of Thoreau. He reads about the 1857 events in India. And he then takes part on the white side in two rebellions in South Africa. There is the British against the Afrikaners, also white, the so-called Boer War. And then there is a Zulu rebellion of the Zulu tribe of South Africa against the British, and it is ruthlessly crushed. But Gandhi leads an ambulance brigade of Indians. He also had taken part in the earlier Boer War as an ambulance man, taken Indians to it. And he sees during both these wars, 1901 and then again in 1906, what war does and what violence does. He is a nurse. He is carrying injured people. He is tending their wounds. And so the direct face-to-face experience of war, his reading and his study, his need to do something against injustice, and so he finds, especially in that Zulu rebellion, when he is leading this Indian ambulance unit, he carries people and walks long miles. He has lots of time for reflection. And that is when this is the summer of 1906, when he gets this deep conviction that really injustice has to be fought, but it should be fought nonviolently. And that is how he gets to his, to what he has then given to the world.
And, you know, one might wonder to what extent this is also a calculation that says the world will look at how we conduct ourselves and how the people on the other side of this conflict conduct themselves, and will weigh up the moral standing of each side and will make some decision perhaps about who is right and which side we want to stand on based on how we all behave. And I wonder to what extent, I mean, clearly there was this very strong commitment to nonviolence as a very basic sort of principle, but whether the other thing was operating as well.
I think it was. I think Gandhi was well aware of how the world would respond to what was happening. And he was well aware, you might say, of the political advantages of having the moral high ground. Absolutely. So, yeah, and he saw that. And in a way, there was no possibility of the Indians acquiring enough arms to fight the white rulers of South Africa. There was just no possibility of that. And the same was true later on in India when he spent 33 years in India after he returned from South Africa, that if it came to a fight with armaments, the British were going to suppress the Indians in no time, as they had done so many times in earlier decades. So it was practically not possible to defeat the British violently. And yes, the moral high ground would give the Indian fight tremendous advantage, even with British public opinion, with American opinion, with world opinion. Mm. I think he was aware of that. And of course, there was also a deep, deep, very deep. It was strategy, but also a principle in his life, yeah.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Rajmohan Gandhi. He is a research professor here at the University of Illinois at the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. He is also the author of Gandhi, The Man, His People, and the Empire, a biography of India's great independence leader, who also was his grandfather. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I was struck as I was looking at some of the reviews of your book that there was also some discussion of a film that looked at the life of what would be your eldest uncle, mm-hmm. Gandhi's first son,
yeah.
and their difficult relationship,
yeah.
And the fact that he had an unhappy life.
Yeah.
And it makes one wonder about the potential burden of having this name. And
yeah.
what it would have been like for we talked earlier about his wife, your grandmother, and how she was really with him all the way through up until the point that she died. There must though have been times when his political activism was very difficult for his family and people and I'm sure his wife, perhaps his children would have said, "What about us? What about your, you know?" And I'm sure he would have maybe talked about his responsibility to the nation. And I would imagine family members might have said, "Well, what about us? What about your family? What sort of sacrifices did the family end up having to make as a part of this struggle?"
Well, this kind of conversation, of course, took place many, many times between the wife and him, and the sons and him, and especially between the eldest son. He was the boy that Gandhi left behind when he went to study mm-hmm. in England. Mm-hmm. And he was only 18 years younger than his father. And in the early years of Gandhi's successful law practice in South Africa, when Gandhi was very successful, earned a good amount of money, had a very comfortable house, had great prestige, that was the phase of life of his father that the eldest son, Harilal, just loved. He felt that was fantastic. But then Gandhi decides to struggle. He decides to embrace poverty as a way of life. That becomes very tough. Then Gandhi can't send his boys to European schools because the other Indians in South Africa cannot. And he wants to lead them, serve them, fight for them. He cannot send them to the... So they are not sent to these good schools. So Gandhi says they will be educated at home, and and some wonderful colleagues of his. I mentioned Henry Pollack; he was one of the teachers of Harilal and the others. But this was not a satisfactory arrangement, so the son's education suffered, and the sons felt neglected. They were being sacrificed for the cause, mm-hmm. And especially because the age difference was so little; they were only 18 years apart. And the eldest son, to begin with, did take part in some of the movements in South Africa. He was in prison for violating laws nonviolently. And Gandhi writes to Tolstoy in Tolstoy's final years with great pride of what his eldest boy is doing. But the older boy is not able to sustain this for any great length of time. And he becomes a rebel. He leaves home. It's very moving. He takes a picture of his father. And Gandhi then sends his friend Herman Cullen back to pursue him and bring him back. And he goes to the port town, Delgoa Bay in Eastern Africa, before he sails to India. He comes back. Cullen back is able to bring Harilal back to the father. Then they have one conversation all night long. Neither of them sleeps. And they have a very great argument. And then the boy goes away. And then he does not have a very successful life. He's not able to keep jobs. He has problems with money. He has problems with alcohol. And he becomes the greatest rebel and the greatest sorrow, the greatest failure of the father and of the mother. And they meet again and again in the remaining subsequent decades. And my eldest uncle, Harilal, died a year or so after my grandfather's death. And shortly after my grandfather's assassination, he came and stayed with us in our home in New Delhi. I was very fond of him. He was very fond of me. He was a wonderful person. But yes, Harilal Gandhi, the eldest son, was the greatest failure and the greatest sorrow of Gandhi's life.
We're now moving into, we have about 5 minutes left, and,
okay.
and there is much in this book, particularly about the Indian independence struggle, about South Africa. I really recommend people read the book. But let me just come down to one other point, as you were talking about, perhaps is one of the great sorrows in his life, his source of sadness was his relationship with his first son and how his life went. If you look at politics, clearly I think he would say his great sorrow was partition, was the fact that India ended up being divided between Hindus and Muslims, and that is how we come to have Pakistan as a Muslim state, as an Islamic state, and also it was what is now Bangladesh. And there was a great deal of violence, and he felt very strongly that India would have been stronger as a multi-religious state if everyone could have lived together, and sadly that did not come to pass. I'm sure that there are people, though, who would argue that if not for him, that might have happened anyway, and things would have been even worse. So, and I wonder how you think about that, and how about he thought about that. And I know that he would have wished different,
yeah.
But that was not the way that it turned out.
Absolutely right, and India's division into two, and then the violence that took place at the time, and which still takes place from time to time on the subcontinent. Yes, that was, you might say, Gandhi's greatest political disappointment. But you're quite right when you say that this was only a partial failure. It was in large part a tremendous success, because today's India, minus Pakistan and Bangladesh, also has a 13% Muslim population. It has a 2.5% Christian population, 2.5% Sikh population, 83% are Hindus. And India today, thanks to Gandhi, offers rights to all minorities in India. It offers justice also to the so-called low caste, so-called untouchables. Why did he fail in keeping India united? Well, there were many on the Hindu side and many on the Muslim side who did not believe in coexistence or cooperation. They really felt that Hindus and Muslims could not live together. Mm-hmm. But they have to live together, said Gandhi, because they are to be found in so many places together. You can't just transfer them. You can't allow one side to dominate the other forever. They just have to. And it is of interest that in Pakistan today and in Bangladesh today and among the Muslims of India today, there is tremendous kind of re-examination of whether it was really wise for us to push for this complete separation. It's also important to recognize that the British, for all the good things they did do during their time in India, towards the end, because they didn't really like the Indian independence movement, I think they contributed to the division.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had also backed his plan for a united India, that actually might. So they also bear some responsibility for what happened. But in short, there was tension between Hindus and Muslims. Gandhi tried very hard to reduce it. He succeeded to a large extent in reducing it. And today many people following him and following many others who also believe in Hindu-Muslim partnership are working away in India, in Pakistan, in Bangladesh. So there's nobody who will suggest that the partition should be undone. But there are so many who would say that India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Hindus and Muslims on the subcontinent must learn to live together.
Yeah, and it's still perhaps one of the most difficult issues today continues to be revolve around that question. And as far as its international relations are concerned, India has concerns about China.
Yes.
But the place where all the conflict has taken place is along that line between India and Pakistan. And trying to sort out that relationship has consumed an awful lot of time and energy of people in government and diplomats along both sides virtually ever since partition. And it continues to be a very difficult issue today, trying to decide what is our relationship one to another.
That is absolutely true. But I think sometimes these headlines of the conflict and the continuing tension conceal the reality of great cooperation and partnership that still takes place between Hindus and Muslims in India. And incidentally, we should also recognize that the question of the relationship between the Muslims and the non-Muslims, which Gandhi addressed in his lifetime, is today something that the whole world faces. So we can learn from Gandhi also, I think, some things about what to do and what not to do as far as addressing that great question which faces really all the nations of the world.
Yeah. Your grandfather was assassinated in 1948. By a Hindu,
yes,
who was among those who felt very strongly that somehow the idea of a multi-religious state having Hindus and Muslims living together just wouldn't work.
Right. Yeah.
Was very opposed to that.
Yeah,
idea.
He was for the group that killed him were for India becoming a Hindu state. And this man and the others who were with him in the conspiracy felt that Gandhi was friendlier than necessary to the Muslims of the subcontinent.
It seems that Hindu nationalism seems to be something that kind of waxes and wanes, never completely goes away.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you think is still likely to be an important current in Indian politics going forward?
It is a powerful current in today's politics. It will be an important current in tomorrow's politics. And to assume that globalization will remove these things is perhaps naive. And yes, there is a version of Hinduism that Gandhi advocated, which is opposed by another version of a kind of strong nationalistic, chauvinistic Hindu nationalism. So yes, this issue will remain with us for a while. Mm.
People revere him and know him in India today. As I said at the beginning, people talk to him as being the father of the nation. At the same time, I would expect that probably Indians, as much as we do, know him in some sense as an iconic figure, but also don't really think of him as being Gandhi the man the way that you do. What's the response in India been to the book?
Well, it's been an amazing response. It's been an absolutely amazing response from reviewers, from readers. The Indian History Congress gives an award every 2 years. So they gave the award to my book for... And people of different kinds, they have welcomed the human Gandhi in quite a way. In fact, some people have also called it a kind of definitive biography. I will read to you a comment by a man called M.V. Kamat. Literally scores of people have written on Gandhi, but this book will henceforth be remembered as the last word on the subject. People have also spoken of the objectivity of this book, and above all, that the human side and the political side, they have been kind of brought together in this.
The book that we're talking about is Gandhi, the Man, His People, and the Empire, by our guest Raj Mohan Gandhi, who is here at the University of Illinois, research professor at the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. If you're interested in meeting him and obtaining a copy, stop by the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4:30. He'll be doing a book signing. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for giving me this chance, David.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. This is a show that was first broadcast on September 9th, and he did indeed that day do the book signing. Unfortunately, I'm sorry to tell you that you have missed it. However, you certainly can go to the bookstore and library and find the book, and I would strongly recommend that you do that. We have many programs available on our website, past shows from Focus 580, other shows here. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. Focus 580, this program made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates offers 4 area locations, including one on the lower level of the Illini Union at the Oasis. That's it for us. Up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine, hosting the program today, Tom Rogers.
Good morning, Dave, and good morning to everybody. In a few moments, it will be time for the Afternoon Magazine. In the 1 o'clock hour today, we'll have an archived interview with Jeffrey Bennett, who is a writer and astrophysicist and the author of the book Beyond UFOs, The Search for Extraterrestrial Life and Its Astonishing Implications for Our Future. That comes up in the 1 o'clock hour after our weekend or our daily look at news in the noon hour. here on AM 580 in the Afternoon Magazine. Taking a look at the commodity markets right now, it's a fairly mixed picture with the wheat mixed all around. Corn is flat to lower. The beans are higher. December wheat in Kansas City right now is up a quarter cent at 562.5. The March at 580, up a quarter. December wheat in Chicago is up a half penny at 534.5. March at 553.5, up three quarters. May wheat down 3.25. That actually was from yesterday's trading, so that's not trading at the moment. December corn in Chicago is down a penny and a quarter a bushel at 352.25. March at 370, down a half. May is unchanged at 381.75. The soybean contract for January, nearby contract up 6.5 cents at 889.5. March at 894.5, up three. The May beans at 903.5, up three.